The following talk was given by Steve Matushak at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on December 5, 2021. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to see you. See that you came out on these icy roads, our first snow last night. I know, at least for me, driving here, and I don't have too far to drive to get to Dharma Field from my home, it was a little slippery, and I'd beat the snowplows barely. I was backing out of my driveway, and I saw them coming, and I went, I got to beat them. I can't be behind them. I got to get to Dharma Field. So anyhow, nice to see you all. See that you made it through the blustery weather. This morning, I'm going to give a talk titled, Not Right. Nope, I'm going to start that over again. You got to get the chain of words correct. Not wrong, nor right, nor left. But this is an illusion. This right here. Me sitting in this room, you sitting in this room, the icy roads, you sitting in your, wherever you are, looking at your computer. It's an illusion. You hear something like that, and you might, your initial instinct might be, I'm guessing not from people here, we've heard this before, but when you encounter this initially, you might go, well, that's crazy. You know you're there, and that person's there, and there's a room, and there's, I don't know, whatever room you're in, there's a computer. You know that that stuff's there. You know the icy roads are there. So how can you say it's an illusion? And that's a great question. First, before I get into talking about how this is an illusion, or at least what we do with it, let me just remind you that I'm not trying to convince you that this is an illusion. So when I point something like that out, I think the instinct is, okay, prove it. That's crazy. That's not the way this is. But that's not actually what my goal is here, is to convince you that that's the case. Rather, it's to invite you to investigate your experience, to slow down and really look at what is showing up. And again, this, what I'm saying here is important as much for people who've heard this is an illusion over and over and over again in various ways, is to stop hearing it that way as a statement of fact and to hear it instead as an invitation. How many of us really don't realize that this room, my being here and your being here and the icy roads and the room you're sitting at looking at the computer, how many of you really stop and look at what that means for a teaching to say this is an illusion and really realize what that's pointing to? There's a quote from Shunryu Suzuki. He's quoting Dogen. I tried finding what Dogen piece this was from, and I couldn't do it. And it actually led me to a Reddit page, which they're already kind of off the rails. But whenever they're talking about Buddhism, you just have to hold your breath because it's often not very wise stuff that's on a Reddit page. As somebody referred to, I'm just going to quote Suzuki. I couldn't find the Dogen quote, but he'd referred to Zen Mind Beginner's Mind as like a cult inculcation textbook. And I just thought, okay. It's just Suzuki's little pointers pointing us to pay attention to what's really showing up. Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. In his essay, Transiency, he talks about teaching. He says, teaching which does not sound as if it is forcing something on you is not true teaching. So again, Suzuki quoting Dogen, teaching which does not sound as if it is forcing something on you is not true teaching. Woo! And so, you know, when you're in a Reddit channel and somebody's referring to this as a cult book, you can kind of see what the person's talking about because you hear something like that and you go, whoa, wait a minute. If that's the way true teaching is, it sounds like it's forcing something on you. Isn't that the way of zealots and despots? Isn't that what they do, is force their ideas on you? I mean, and so does that mean that zealots and despots are offering true teaching? But I would invite you actually to pause for a moment and think about teachings of, say, a despot, for example, and ask yourself if, for those who are willing to follow the despot, don't those teachings just go down easy? Are they really feeling like they're forced on you? Or do they just kind of push a button and you go, yes, that's right? Or do you do completely the opposite and it's just, you just completely shut it out. You completely reject it because it just sounds like absolute nonsense to you. It seems to me that what Suzuki's pointing about these teachings that he's saying are true teachings is that they stick in your craw. Right? They seem like they're forced on you because it sticks in you. What you hear goes against your common sense. This is an illusion. And yet, something about it resonates, or it seems to touch something. And in that way, you can't just simply reject it, you don't easily swallow it. There's something going on there. It sounds like a teaching that goes against the way you might normally see things, but something about it makes sense. So perhaps you simply don't believe that this is an illusion, or as I said before, you've heard it so often that you don't really hear it, and you go about your life. We all do this, you know, this world of illusion of appearances shows up, and we understand, we conceptualize what's going on, and then it's, I don't want to say it's natural, but it's just something that we do. We grab hold of those conceptualizations, and that's what we live out of, and we're not really hearing this is an illusion. But you know that something isn't quite right in grabbing hold of this world of illusion. Something feels wrong. I think I mentioned this the last talk that I was engaging with a person who said, don't you ever get the sense that the world isn't really substantial the way it seems to be? Of course, he filled in that sense with a whole another theory about how the world worked and what was going on. But we don't have to do that. This is an illusion, is not some theory that you now need to just, I'm sensing something's not quite right, so now I'm going to dump this theory in there. If you're doing that, you're actually taking the teaching the way that I'm suggesting we tend to do. We hear it and we go, okay, yeah, heard it. I know, I understand that's how that's going. Suzuki goes on to say in Transiency, he says, the teaching itself is true and in itself does not force anything upon us, but because of our human tendency, we receive the teaching as if something was being forced on us. Right, so the teaching itself isn't forcing anything on us. I mean, teaching is just pointing to reality. Reality is unfolding regardless of what it is that we believe. But because of our human tendency, and I want to look at that human tendency, because of that human tendency, we feel like something's being forced on us. And I would say that is true because these teachings I'm talking about seem to go against common sense. They seem to go against how we understand the world is. It contradicts our beliefs. And when something contradicts our beliefs, you know what happens. You start getting defensive. I mean, that's what happens. You feel a little shaky maybe, and you want to argue. Or if you can bite your tongue, you still are shaken by this somewhat. So we get defensive because our identity is being threatened. This is very important. So those beliefs that we have, we identify with them. They become us. When somebody starts yanking at your beliefs, woohoo! I mean, that can be scary. It can be aggravating because we identify with those beliefs. What we believe in is us. And it's the danger of any kind of ism, is a belief system that then you identify with. I'm a this. I saw a bumper sticker once that said something like, I am a conservative Catholic voter. And I remember I read that and I went, what on earth is that supposed to mean? Like, what am I supposed to do about that? Rear end their car or when they follow them around till they get out of the car and shake their hand? I mean, I'm not quite sure I understand, but very clearly these markers the person has is important. And to challenge that in any way whatsoever would be to challenge who they are. So, as Suzuki says then, you know, our human tendency makes it feel as if teachings that are pointing out the truth, that are asking us to really look at reality and let go of our beliefs, feel then as if that teaching is being forced on us. Now, something else to remember about these teachings, so I say this is an illusion, and like I said, you've all encountered this teaching, probably all of you, most of you have encountered this teaching in one way or another. The thing that's important is when you hear that, now don't memorize it. I mean, something this simple, you don't have to do a lot of memorization. I think I've mentioned this maybe in my recent class. For somebody who's as in love with words and language as I am, I can hear a beautifully phrased sentence or idea, and then in a second, I completely don't remember how it was phrased at all, and I can only summarize it, and the way I summarize it removes all the profundity and depth from the thing that I heard, and then I start scrambling trying to, oh, no, it was actually pointing at this. But these teachings aren't meant to be memorized. Sure, you're going to remember. Mary's got an incredible memory of the Fukan Zazengi because she recites it every week. And probably even more so, you know, when you sit sessions and we recite, or when you sit in extended Zazen and we recite Fukan Zazengi. So passages show up. That does happen, you know. But the teachings aren't, I'm not speaking them, and I don't think they're being written in the spirit that then you sit there and you go over the passages and you kind of memorize it so that you can mindlessly repeat it and just parrot what a teacher is saying. And there are a lot of teachings that we know in this tradition that tell us, don't just memorize what the teacher's doing and then parrot that back. Because that's not what this teaching is interested in at all. I mean, you can do that, but you know, that's on you. So we have the story Gute's one finger. I think we all know that, kind of a gruesome story. But it gets right at the heart of that. And that's the, you know, Master Gute, whenever he was questioned, his answer would be to raise that one finger. And then he had the way they put it in Cleary's translation of the Mumon Khan, there was a servant boy that whenever outsiders would ask him what the master taught, he would put his finger up. Because he saw the teacher doing that. Question? Teacher would. So what did your master teach? And then Gute, of course, heard about that, called the boy into his chambers and cut the boy's finger off, asked him the question, got the answer, cut his finger off. The boy, of course, understandably ran crying in pain out of the room. And just before he got out of the room, Gute called his name. Boy turned, Gute raised his finger, and the boy was awakened at that moment. Now there's one more twist to this koan that I forgot about that is actually pertinent to what I'm talking about this morning. And that's when Gute was about to die. So after we get that little story, then there's a little postscript kind of. It says, when Gute was about to die, he said to a group, I have attained my teacher Koshu Tenryu's one finger Zen and have used it all my life without exhausting it. So saying, he passed away. So I want you to think of what happened there. You know, we have the boy imitating his master. And I think we probably have even seen or heard people do that where they're just sort of repeating back what somebody else has said, and you can tell they don't have any understanding of it. When I was in graduate school, one of my professors was a woman who had written a very important book about the French psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan. And Lacan is, for many people, he's nonsense because he wrote in this incredibly opaque style that people weren't even sure Lacan knew what he was writing about. And yet all of my professor's peers talked about Lacan and his ideas as if they knew what the hell he was talking about. And nobody could understand. So she actually took it upon herself. She realized that there was something, you know, she could hear in those students. They were just parroting what the student was, or what Lacan was saying, just using the words, using the phrases, but in a blustery kind of way that seemed to, if you read enough academic writing, it feels sometimes like what they're doing is trying to confuse matters to make it look deeper than it is. I don't think it's really true. I think in a lot of cases, person's trying to write something that's difficult to write about, and they may not be up to it. And so you get this kind of clumsy, difficult writing. But she just sensed that these grad students were just, you know, I get Lacan. So she went back to Lacan and she did what's called close reading. She did literary, scrupulous literary, just parsing his metaphors and stuff like that to really understand what it was that Lacan was pointing out from her own understanding, rather than just aping the language, really taking this apart. And that's what the finger is. That boy was just repeating what his teacher was saying, was taking the teaching to be the truth. And so Goethe was showing the student that, the boy that, by cutting the finger off. And Rick, you mentioned about in your talk on Wednesday evening and on Sunday about how that, you know, you can get caught in that too and go, that's a pretty cruel thing for a Zen master to cut off a student's finger. But you were talking about there are many stories like that where there's sort of bodily transformations that seem to indicate really the transformation of consciousness of the person who's encountering that seeming violence. And so with that boy, Goethe brings him right back to reality so that all it takes is the pointer again and the boy can understand what's going on. But we might hear this story and go, I get it. Don't, you know, it may not be as literal as don't point your finger, but it's don't say what your teacher says. Because then you'll figuratively get your finger cut off if that's what happens. You know? But if you look at the end of the story, the koan with Goethe, he was just doing what his teacher did. One finger's on. One finger's on. What is that one finger's on, though? Is it one finger? Is it pointing one finger? Is that what he means by one finger's on? Could be. But why didn't he get his finger cut off? Or slammed in a door? Or why didn't he get whacked on the head and stop doing it? And I think that this is an important aspect of these teachings. And so when you hear this is an illusion, yeah, you can go ahead and say that. You can go, okay, I got it. Yeah, write that on my checklist. This is an illusion. And then at a party, you can pull that out of your hat. You know, you're sipping cocktails or whatever. And you go, you know, this is actually an illusion. I don't know if you ever do that, but you go ahead and do that. But these teachings are showing us that's not the teaching. That's not what the teaching is. So don't get fixated on the words. Don't get fixated on the language. Don't get fixated on, and don't get fixated on being fixated on. You actually want to understand. Think about what that professor that I studied with, what she did with Lacan. She didn't then, when she saw the graduate students were getting it all wrong, just give up. And she didn't stop using Lacan's language. Instead, she studied it. She looked at it. Does that make sense? Like she got to know it. She really understood it. And then she could use the teaching, the language. Suzuki has got a amusing anecdote, actually, where he talks about in Dokusana, a student repeated something to him that he'd said in a lecture. And teachers will hear this from time to time. Well, you said this. This is what you said. And sometimes the wording doesn't sound right. You go, well, it's probably not exactly what I said. But if I said it that way, I'm sorry. You know. But sometimes you'll hear the exact words, but you can tell that there isn't understanding there. So this student said to Suzuki, you know, this is what you said in your lecture. And Suzuki shook his head. And the student said, now, they repeated what he said and then said, is this right? And he shook his head. And the student said, well, no, but you know, in your talk, he said, and Suzuki just said, well, when I said it, it was true. When you said it, it was false. And there's something really wonderful about the directness of that, because he's pointing to what I'm talking about. Yeah, the student said it, but they're saying it back without any understanding. So again, these teachings require that move where you actually look at what's being pointed out. You actually experience and realize it. So you don't want to make something out of the teachings. You don't want to, that's not the point of the teachings, to make something out of them. And in fact, I brought this up in a recent talk, and Rick, you referred to it too. It might have been my last talk here. Just thinking about another Suzuki Roshi story that I like, which is the one where the clinical psychologist asks Suzuki Roshi about consciousness. And he said, well, I don't know anything about consciousness. I just try to teach my students how to hear the birds sing. And that little teaching to me is rich in so many ways. But one of the things we can see in that is you get something like the word consciousness, you know, which we can see as a technical term. And we can get caught up in terms like that. So you hear consciousness and you encounter something like that. And I'm just using that because it's in this particular passage. But you want to watch yourself because it's so easy to get caught up in a term like that where you go, oh, consciousness, what are they talking about? What does this consciousness mean? And what we're doing, of course, is we're trying to figure out what it means. We may not think we're doing this, but we're trying to get it so that we can write it down on a piece of paper, put it in our hat, and when we're at a cocktail party, we can pull it out of our hat and talk about what consciousness is. And we're trying to get an understanding of what it is that that word's saying. And we can see that what we're doing at that moment, often when we encounter a teaching like this, is we're trying to get an intellectual understanding of the word. Now, this isn't necessarily a problem. If somebody's saying a sentence, I used to do this with my students that I taught when I was an English teacher at a community college. You know, you got to know what a word means. So I'm certainly not saying you shouldn't know what a word means. We would read passages and there'd be a word in there and I'd go, I know they're not going to know that word because I had to look it up just to make sure that I got it right, you know. They're not going to know that word. And not only that, but it occupies an important part of that sentence. It'd either be like the subject of the sentence or it would be the predicate, what was going on. It'd be one of the two things. So without knowing what the word meant, you weren't going to be able to understand the sentence. So, of course, I would ask in class, how many of you looked this word up? This was truer at the beginning of the semester. After a while, you know, anyone who's taught knows there are some students that always want to impress the teacher. So after a while, they'll start looking stuff up. But at the beginning of the semester, nobody, you know. And you're like, okay, how did you understand this sense? What do you think this word means? And then they'll guess. And that's good. You know, part of this is that investigation I'm talking about. When you look at a word and you don't know it, you kind of take other words that you know and you compare it with those and you go, okay, I think I see what's going on here. And 9 out of 10 times, you're wrong. I remember when I first started reading with the dictionary, I was sort of surprised at how often I was wrong in my guesses. I was like, oh, it means the opposite. So they would, you know, they would kind of tell me the word they guessed and then we would read the sentence and it would make no sense at all. So then I'd go, you guys, when you don't look up a word, it's basically like, especially if it occupies an important part of the sentence like that, it's sort of like I'm saying, blah, 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 what, blah, 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 blah. Then that's how the sentence is to you. So we do need to, when we encounter a term and we don't really know what it means, you do want to understand how it's being used or you're not going to even be able to see what the pointer is. So I'm not saying don't understand intellectually what the word is, but notice that's what we do. Just notice that's what we do. That when we have a word, consciousness, oh, how's this using consciousness and burning? So notice you're doing that. Because again, that's not the spirit with which Suzuki wants you to engage in that language. He wants you to hear the bird sing. They don't really care about the word consciousness. So your ability to flip that out, back out, is unnecessary. And I would say, especially with something like consciousness, that sounds like a deep word, we might have a sense that a word like that, when a person is using it, this gets back to those graduate students I was talking about with Lacan, that if they're using that kind of language, that somehow what they're talking about is realer or deeper or more profound than a teaching about hearing the birds. You know, so our tendency is to think there's something really going on there. So I better figure that out and be able to just spit that back out again. But again, what the teachings are really doing is asking us to look what they're pointing to. And what is that? Well, it's this. And that's going to bring us back to how it is that we normally think we take in the world. And that how we normally think we take in the world is illusion. And I'm putting "take in" quotation marks, because that's the way we normally do it. We think there's a world out there and I'm here and I'm taking it in. When we hear a teaching like this, that you know, what this is illusion, this world is illusion. And we might hear, oh, I know what he's saying now. And believe me, I'm not saying you're going to necessarily go, I agree with this. But you might hear that and go, yeah, what you're telling me is that the world I live in is false. That it's not true. And even more so, that if I see the world that way, if I see that this false world is actually true, then I'm wrong, you know, then I got it wrong. You might say, I'm bad. I'm a bad Zen student. I can't see that this is the way it is. But what we want to realize, of course, is that what you just want to realize what you're doing there. You're just doing more of the mind games. Nobody's telling you it's bad to have a false view of what's taking place. I mean, language makes us kind of hard because everything I say sounds like I'm being negative, false. You know, you say wrong. I had wrong in my notes originally. I crossed that word out because that's not what's really taking place. So the teachings will tell us that if we believe that this world has substance, that these appearances are things that are real, that they have some real reality to us, if the teachings tell us that if we believe that, we're ignorant, that ignoring is really taking place, we think, because who wants to be ignorant? Who wants to ignore things? We think there's something bad in that. Suzuki tells us in that chapter, Transiency 2, he says, but whether we feel good or bad about it, this truth exists, right? So this gets back to what he was saying before with the teaching. The truth of the teaching is still happening. Whether we think it's forced on it or not, that's our doing, right? Whether or not we feel good or bad about what we're hearing or what we encounter, the truth exists. So reality appears to us this way, just like this. That's the way it appears to us. And then we act as if those appearances have substance. And we hear this, we might hear this teaching that actually I don't want to jump the gun here too quickly. All right, that's it. If somebody's going to tell us that appearances don't have substance, we're going to think that there's some kind of a reality that transcends appearance. In other words, that there's this appearance, the way we normally think of it, and you just peel that back. If you just peel it back, you can find something that's realer, that's truer. And we think that that's what the teachings are pointing out to us. And we can encounter this in any of a variety of ways. It could sound like, you know, reality is an illusion. But again, you know, if you've heard it before, it might just be something you go, I don't know. Either you think it's not, you know, some bunk, or you might think, I don't understand how this is going to help me live my life. You know, it might be something like, okay, Mr. Know-it-all, this is an illusion. That's all fine and dandy, but now I got to go balance my checkbook. Okay, so I return back to planet Earth. Okay, and I got to balance my checkbook. And there's something in that idea. I mean, I know people think this, I've heard things like this from people, you know. Well, that's fine. Your head's in the clouds. Let's get back to this right there. This is where it's at. This is real reality. And that other stuff is talk, you know, or if it's not talk, if you think, well, there's something to it, but still, this is the real reality. There's a sense that balancing the checkbook is somehow a realer reality than the fact that appearances are an illusion. Or there's a sense that when you hear a teacher saying this is an illusion, that what they're saying is that what they're pointing out is realer than balancing your checkbook, which isn't what the teachers are doing at all, right? What is being pointed out is in no way intended to assault the idea that you have to drive a car, that you have to balance your checkbook, or that there's a podium here. You know, it's not meant to assault that, but we might hear that. Teacher saying this is an illusion, so there's something that's realer, like I said, that sense that there's something real behind them, the appearances that the teacher's pointing out to us. But if we take a look at that realer world that we think is going on, that we always have to bring the teachers, it's like people feel they need to teach the teachers that reality is really not the way that they're saying it is. But if you start thinking about that, these more prosaic things that show up in your life, again, just ask yourself about them. That's really what the teachers are asking you to do. This reality that we think is realer than what we hear is being pointed out by this is an illusion. Or the reality that, no, it's just a reality we think we need to come back to. What are the things in that reality? And that's what I think we don't always interrogate. Because just so you're going so fast. I mean, life goes so fast. You don't have time to sit there. It's like you can sit every time something's coming at you that you go, yes, I see. I see that this is an illusion. You know, you don't. It's really not what the teachers are asking you to do, but we can take it that way. But there are exercises. There are things you can do just to kind of slow down and see something about the nature of reality. And there's one that I've talked about a number of times in my talks that was presented by a Dharma Field member that I like, Scott Edelstein. And he was just talking about how it is that we package the world and how we can easily see, you know, as if we need some kind of exercise to help us to see. But if you really want to see how pervasive it is that we package up the world, just do his exercise, which is get up in the morning and you get a notepad with you, a pencil. I suppose you could do that thing where you get your electronic thing. You could just talk into it. It'd be easier. You just go. And every time things don't go the way that you thought they were going to, record that. And that's just like you got up and you bumped your shin on the bed. Well, that clearly wasn't in the plan, I would think, unless you planned to bump your shin on the bed. You know, you dropped your t-shirt as you're putting it on. Okay, so you write these things down. I'm guessing you weren't planning on dropping your t-shirt. You didn't think that was going to happen. No. You go into the bathroom and fumble to get the light switch up. Oh, there's another thing. You know, this is real. You have all these expectations about what the reality is. And then what is it that we encounter? Well, accidents, you know. That's the way we think of it. It's like, well, there's reality, and then there are these things like dropping a t-shirt or fumbling for the light or, you know, banging your shin. And those are the accidents. And so we almost kind of forget that's really what's taking place. I mean, we're aware of it. You bang your shin. I really banged mine the other day pretty bad. And, you know, you're aware of that. You go, ow, you know, but I don't, the whole chain of events there was just sort of like, you know, scolding myself for not paying attention, walking around, whatever I was doing, with my head in the clouds. I think I was actually writing a talk. Sometimes I walk around and I write them. I bang my table, or my leg up against something right there. That feels real, but again, we think of it as an accident, you know, as something that's outside of reality. And the only reason I bring this up, the reason I like this exercise is that it works on so many different levels, but it can just help you to see that how you package the world up isn't the way that, or the way you package reality up isn't the way that reality is going to show up. And that should be a pointer that something's going on there, that we have expectations about the world. And some of this resistance that I was talking about before to teachings, for example, really have to do with our expectations of the world and not with the nature of reality whatsoever. And we do the same thing with the teachings. So again, Scott's exercise, if you were to do it, you'd have a huge list. it would just be this huge list, because constantly reality is just unfolding as it's going to unfold. Constantly. And we engage it with our conceptions about what's going on. The same thing with this practice and these teachings. So for example, you might encounter the teaching of not self and then think that it's wrong to hold on to an idea of self. And again, that's not what the teachings are pointing to at all. No, they're just inviting you to look back. What is that self you're talking about? Just what is that thing? Where is it? How do you understand it? So it's not necessarily about it being wrong, because you do that and you start going, well, now I believe in the sense of self. And again, you will hear people do this as they're talking. And they go, well, they start to undo the sense of self they were just talking about. But that sense of self that's showing up, that's what's showing up. We're actually telling you or pointing out to you in what we're saying to you to notice that that's what's going on, that self is showing up there. Not to try to get rid of it or say that it's wrong. It's to go, hey, look what you're doing. What is that thing that you're hanging on to? That's it. So then we don't have to worry about if we come across a teaching in not self and we think it's wrong to have an idea of a self, and then we start thinking of a self and we go, oh my God, I'm just not doing this right. I always feel a sense of self. I must not be doing this. Let that go. You know, if you think about what you're doing, you're just making it all about you. Even if it's a teaching that you're thinking right there, you're thinking that, well, this isn't about me. There is no self. I don't have, you know, there you are. You're making it all about you again. And the other thing that's happening there, of course, is as we do things like that, and we don't want to be wrong. Right? We don't want to be wrong because we want to be right. We don't want to be wrong. We want to be right. It's not anything wrong with that. You know, just notice that. That's our thing too. We want to be right. This way isn't about right or wrong. There's a great story. I know I've referenced it recently, but I think it's a wonderful story. And it's about that, about how our practice isn't about being right or wrong. And that's really hard. I mean, that was hard for me. I spent a lot of my life making sure people knew that I knew what was right, that I had the answer, or that what they were telling me was wrong. But we have this story about Hakuin. Is that so? And a familiar story for many people. But we have Hakuin, I'm trying to remember, he was 18th century Zen master, I think, in Japan. And he was, you know, seen as a teacher who lived a pure life. And there was a beautiful girl that lived nearby. And her parents, I'm just reading or kind of scanning the details of this story as it's told in Zen Flesh, Zen Bones. And her parents owned a food store, and then suddenly they discovered their daughter was with child. And of course, the parents were very upset about this, and they tried to get her to say who the parent or who the father was, and she wouldn't say who it was. And, you know, sure, there was a lot of gnashing of teeth going on here, probably tears and screaming and yelling. And so finally the girl just caved in. She said, okay, the father of my child is Hakuin, right? This great Zen master. And so when the child was born, it was brought to Hakuin. And oh, first, before they bring the child, of course, the parents confront Hakuin and go, we know you're the father of the child. And Hakuin's response to that is, that so? That's how he responds. And then when the child is born, by this point, Hakuin's reputation was in ruins. This is a guy, again, who had a reputation for living a pure life. His reputation was in ruins. It was in tatters. And the parents came and they gave him the baby. And he took very good care of that baby, best that he could. A year after the baby had been born, the girl, who was the mother of the child, she couldn't take it anymore. And she confessed to her parents. She told them the truth, who the father really was. It was a young man at the fish market. Well, of course, then the parents feel terrible and they go to Hakuin and they beg his forgiveness and they ask for the child again. And Hakuin yields the child to them, and his response is that so? Again, a familiar story. I know many of us have heard it many, many times before, but just think about what's going on there. And then we think, well, I couldn't do what Hakuin is doing. And we think that what Hakuin did is he took in a baby and he raised the baby as his own for a year, and then he gave that baby away again. And that's what he did. And it was probably really hard for him to give up that baby that he'd been taking care of for a year, you know? But that's not what the story is about. The story isn't like, be like Hakuin, you know? Now I'm talking about, you know, going back to the other teaching, the one finger, gute. But is Hakuin what he did with that baby? Is that the one finger? So that's not what's being pointed out here. What's being pointed out here is that Hakuin knew he wasn't the father of that child. They didn't sit there and argue about, you know, I know that I'm right here. You know, he just didn't do that. Now, does that mean that the Buddhist teachings are saying that when you know something's right or wrong, you just act like you don't know? Again, that would be doing the wrong thing. That would be doing, well, the wrong thing. That would be doing sort of distorting the teachings. That would be taking them and making them do something. Instead, all it's really saying is this has nothing to do about right or wrong. So Hakuin didn't even engage in that. This is just about taking care of the moment that needs to be taken care of. There was a young woman, and she really needed to be taken care of at that moment. Then there was a child, and that needed to be taken care of at that moment. That's it. That's it. No right or wrong. And we get caught up in this stuff because we're still caught up in this world of illusion. The thing we think, yeah, I got it. I understand. I mean, the reason we get so caught up in this stuff, we get so involved in this because we don't really understand. That's okay. You know, in confusion is awakening. There's a passage in the Vimalakirti Sutra, Buddha's talking to Shariputra. The Buddha says, this Buddha land of mine is always pure, but appears filthy, so that I can lead people of inferior spirituality to their salvation. Now you're going to hear something, oh, inferior spirituality. You're going to get hung up on that. Let that go. Listen to what the Buddha's pointing to. He's saying that this world, this Buddha land of mind, this reality is always pure, but it appears filthy so that people can be saved, so that people can wake up. So what I'm trying to say is, you know, we get confused about this stuff. Don't go, I got that wrong, you know. Oh, you can do that. Just notice you're doing that. This isn't about a don't do this, do this. You can go ahead and feel that you're wrong. Just notice you're doing that. That's really what this is about, is what's showing up right now. Notice that's what's taking place. Getting something wrong, getting caught up in false views, having ideas about things, and then, you know, bumping up against reality with them, having to come up with that list of ways that reality is letting us down, right? That's how we wake up. That's where we realize that the way we package the world, the way we automatically, like automatons, go through the world with this, you know, picture of the world we move through, and then we bump up against reality. And it's because we're bumping up against reality, not literally, it just seems like it, because we have ideas about what's showing up. You bang your shin and you have ideas about it shouldn't happen. What happened? There it is. So what the teaching then is helping us to see is that this confusion we have, this is where we wake up. It really can't be any other way. But confusion is where we wake up. It's from that place. And it's often when we're really confused. We talk about, you know, when you're caught up in confusion, you're just caught up in confusion. You know, but we can feel that confusion is confusion. You know, you come up against it, then you're really confused. Because then the way you thought the world was isn't. And that's confusing. Well, what's going on? What is this? There. That's a great place. That's where we wake up when we go, what is this? You don't know. Not knowing mind. Not being certain about it, but instead being uncertain about it. and being open to what it really is. What is this? And then not rushing to put an answer. Or when we do, notice you're doing that. Oh, look what I just did. That's what I do now. It's like, look at that. I've got this all worked out. You know, we can see we're doing that. So, you know, this passage, I quoted this last time too from our chant books. In this world of emptiness, may we exist in muddy water with purity like a lotus. Nothing surpasses the mind. Thus we bow to Buddha. There's nothing wrong with this world of muddy water. That's the world of confusion. That's where we live. That's the world of our checkbooks. That's the world of our cars and our icy roads and our scabbed shins and whatever it is. That's the world we live in. That's where we wake up. This is great. So this is an illusion. This is where we wake up. No need to dismiss it and go, yeah, I got it, and not really engage with it. No need to go, that's just crazy. Let's get back to the real thing here. Just notice. That's it. What is it that's showing up? Even as you're doing that. Nah. Or got it. Just notice you're doing that. Because none of that is necessary, but we do it. We want to see that we're doing that. You know, as Norm points out from us from time to time, he says, things are not as they appear, nor are they otherwise. You know, it's a storied teaching. It's a great teaching. Things are not as they appear, nor are they otherwise. I remember when I heard Norm say that, I was like, it was one of those things you go, you know, I don't want to say being forced on you, but it's stuck in my craw. I went, well, that's great. What the heck does it mean? And I remember that one time I brought a friend from California, San Francisco. I brought her here, and Norm was teaching, and he made that teaching. And afterwards, she goes, see, that's the thing about Zen that just drives me crazy. What does that mean? You know, so, but, you know, sit and listen to it. And we know there's something there that's right, something that resonates. Things are not as they appear, nor are they otherwise. But this is our world. This is our reality. This is the world of illusion. This is the world of waking up. It's a world that's annoying, painful, and confusing, and beautiful, and comforting, peaceful, and rich. And we can see that. That's a long talk, so I'm going to stop now. If you have questions or comments, I welcome them. Yeah, David?
Well, I probably don't need to explain this, but when you say the world is an illusion, things are not as they appear, it seems in a way that it's self-contradictory. I'm not arguing with it, but when you say that, it relies, I think, on the concept of self. Okay? So you're using the concept of self to prove that the self is an illusion, and that the world is an illusion. And my concern is this kind of broad, because I don't have any problem with you saying that, but I understand the step of being in what you can. But the broad problem for me is explaining Zen concepts using conventional language. And that's always kind of an approximation, right? But they never really hit the mark, and maybe that's just the point of it, right? That by explaining things using conventional terms and words, we're always going to miss the mark somehow, just like might be occurring here. So do you have any comments on that? Do you understand what I think what I'm trying to say?
I believe so. You're saying that the teaching that I offer here, that this is an illusion, this sense that you're here and I'm here, and that word illusion is
it would give illusion to a person, and therefore it relies on the concept of self, right? And that in that way it would be self-contradictory.
Well, the illusion I'm talking about are just the appearances, right? So things appear to be a certain way, and they're not, well, you know, as we say, they're not as they appear.
And I would say to who? Yeah. And I would say to who, right? Which requires the concept of self. And I agree with you. I'm not trying to give you a difficult time, but I'm kind of pointing out my difficulties expressing Buddhist concepts and understanding them using conventional language that we're all aware of.
Yeah. And there, that part of your question gets to, yeah, you can't ever get this in words exactly.
Right.
No matter, I could use specialized, you know, language from the Pali Canon, and it's still not going to get at it. It's not, you know, it has nothing to do with the type of language you're using. But I still want to say this illusion we're talking about, that's just the nature of, you know, these are appearances. It's that you don't have to necessarily say it's to a person. Now, it's delusion if you take the illusions to have substance. But the illusion is just this appearance. It appears to be this way, but it's not necessarily this way. Not necessarily to any person. It's just reality has to appear. Right? Without that, how is this, right? I mean, here it is. There are these appearances. So we can be deluded. Or what is some of the, you know, have a false view about those illusions and think that they're real, right? So that's, the illusion is still, we'll say, showing up. The appearances are still there. To whom, that's, that question points at, and I think this is kind of what you're saying, that points at, like, the fundamental confusion that we have, is we think there needs to be somebody in there, right? That's somebody that is experiencing the illusion.
Yes.
Right. And no. There's reality is just showing up. And it appears this way. But we think there's got to be somebody. And perhaps what you're saying, even to clarify it a little greater, is that you're saying that for it to be an illusion, there has to be somebody there. Is that correct? Or did I take it too far there?
Well, no, I don't think you are taking it too far. Because the way I think most people use the word illusion, it means that something is not true in the way that it appears to be a self.
Yeah, so you can just erase that last part. The self is that fundamental issue that we cling to and think it's got to be there, partly because, as you were saying before, with language, you know, it really is an issue of language. I think I've mentioned this before. I have read some attempts at writing that try to get rid of subjects. And, you know, it's pretty incomprehensible stuff because that's not how language works. So the language almost seems to insert that self in there. But, this world of illusion, you don't have to put a self in there. That's the thing. So the real question you want to ask yourself, I think those are great questions. To whom? How are these? What are these appearances? What is actually taking place here? I don't want to say for whom are they showing up, you know, or who is experiencing them. But when we have that sense that we need to have somebody experiencing them, just examine that. And that's it. You can just, and then let it go. You don't even have to sit there with it and wrestle with it. If you want to, you can. But that's when we start to get into kind of an intellectual understanding. And this teaching is experiential. I mean, really, like, knowing this podium, you know, which we know isn't exactly this podium, but it appears to us as this podium. But knowing it is seeing it, feeling it, and looking at it, and it's not having to have an intellectual understanding of it. So at some point, though, it can be helpful to ask these kind of questions and grapple a little bit, but just know you're never really going to get the answer there. So you can see, as I was pointing out before, that our tendencies to want to have an intellectual understanding. But getting back to your illusion, yeah, it's not, I say just here at Dharma Field, we definitely make distinctions between illusion and delusion that I think is helpful. An illusion is just something that appears to be something that it's not, right? And delusion is believing that it is what it appears to be, right? And that's where the self comes up. It appears that there's a self here, but when we believe that that self has some kind of substance to it, that's when we get confused. So, but it's a great question. Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Yeah, Mary.
That was an excellent
talk. I'm sorry, what?
I'm sorry. That was an excellent talk. You touched on an argument that you had this very morning about an article in the New Yorker about consciousness and a person in a persistent vegetative state and how they're supposedly communicating with people in persistent vegetative states using MRIs. And it's all very, lots of stuff there. And how in the future, we're going to be able to use computers to somehow clarify communication, mind-to-mind, without even speaking to one. And to me, this is just kind of like total, utter, complete insanity. And I may talk about it next week. I'll give a talk briefly.
That'd be great.
It touches on what you just said, but it also touched on my reaction to what David said, because after all, how many years did I spend as a neuropsychologist? So it got me at my identity. I got pissed off because as you were saying, my identity entered the picture.
Yeah.
It was great. It was really an excellent moment.
Okay.
I feel like you all did, not me all. I did caught there. They got caught. They don't get a data about it.
Yeah.
So I made the article is very interesting. I made it to John in the room.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. Yeah.
That was very helpful.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that is honestly where you start to see, you know, you might take up this practice for quite a while and go, yeah, I've you know, I don't know. We'd put it this way. I've let that ego behind. But then you, then there are those areas where you find yourself doing that, and you go, "Oh, wait a minute. I've identified with something or another." You know, and you may not have thought it was that strong until you encountered something that shook that. You know, yeah. So thanks. Yeah, it's very subtle, and I think that's wonderful to encounter that. You know, it might kind of suck. Yeah, yeah. No, that's the thing. It doesn't feel that way at all, you know. And that's where we get into the good or that good or bad again. It feels bad or it feels, you know, wrong. And that's again where we can see that something's going on. We can at least see something's going on. And usually in those moments, that's where you really feel it. So not that we should run around trying to be wrong, but when we get the sense that something's tugging at our identity or knocked it or whatever it is, but whatever those painful moments are, we can, those are the ones that are like, what did I call them? Like the alarm on your oven is going off. The cookies are ready. You know, it's that sort of thing. Reality is like beeping. It's the alarm on your oven telling you, alarm, get the cookies out of there. They're going to burn, you know, that kind of thing. Pay attention. Thanks. Anything else?
Here we go. Come on, Judy.
You can go ahead, Jay. Jay?
Judy.
Oh, Judy. Go ahead, Judy.
Sorry, I wasn't sure that you would take questions from people on Zoom. Regarding that Cohen with the priest who took the baby, I guess I'm getting the impression that if in order to achieve the kind of calm, stressless life that you seek, that you have to give up a lot. And in this case, you have to give up like fighting for your rights. If you're going to be just in the moment, taking care of what needs to be taken care of without arguing, you're giving up a lot. You're giving up fighting for, which you've probably done all your life, which I've done all my life, let's say, to make things better for yourself or whatever. I just wanted to know what you thought about that, if that makes any sense.
It does. And, you know, again, when we really look at it, what, you know, you're talking about you give up so much. Really, what I would say Hakuin would be giving up would just be some idea he had about how life was supposed to be. You know, he doesn't display that at all here. But what we normally would be, it's like, let's see if I come up with an example from my personal life. When I, there was a point, I was a very restless young man, still tend toward restlessness. And at some point in my life, I just was totally unsatisfied with the way it was going. It wasn't supposed to be the way it was. And I thought that the answer to that would be to go to graduate school. You know, and so then I thought, well, not only am I going to go to graduate school, but I'm going to move to California, Northern California or Oregon or Washington, because I want to get out of the Midwest. It was the Midwest's fault. I didn't really put it that way, but I was like, I got to get out of the Midwest. And then then I got a call from my mom that she had terminal cancer. And I just thought, oh no, I mean, that's terrible news. So then I looked at all my plans, which were to move from Minneapolis out to California and move thousands of miles away from my mom, or however many thousand plus miles it is. And that was a struggle for me, only because I had already envisioned a future, you know. But once I let that go and went, okay, all this means is I got to go to school in the Midwest so that I can drive home and help take care of her. And I just took care of that. That pain went away. So I don't know, Judy, if that helped answer your question, but the struggle we have really isn't with losing a lot, because we don't really have that stuff. That's part of the illusion, right? It's a sense we have of what our life is supposed to look like, what we're supposed to have. And that's where the sense of loss comes in. And that's, of course, again, where we can notice that we have that sense, like, I'm not going to give that up. And think about how many of those we have in a day. They can be something pretty little. You know, like, well, it's just a Ritz cracker with a little peanut butter smeared on it. You know what I mean? It's not going to hurt the world if I have that. I'm not going to give that up. Whatever it is. That what I think you're pointing to is just that what it is that we feel like we're losing is just some idea we have about the way it's supposed to be. And yeah, that can cause us great pain. That can be a very difficult obstacle.
So it's about expectations, a lot of it.
Yeah. Right.
Thank you. That does help. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for your question. It looks like I took us over. I'm sorry about that, everyone, but there are great questions and comments. And I want to again thank you all for being here today.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.